Williamson versus Sterling and others. Mr. Johnson? Good to have you here, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Before his trial, Mr. Williamson spent more than 3 years in solitary confinement. Defendants never gave him any due process, not for the first solitary confinement order, nor for any of the 11 subsequent orders.
Well, I think it's important to go through what each of these defendants had to do with this. Did Sheriff Carroll know this fellow was in solitary?
Sheriff Carroll is the person who's in charge of the.
He's the sheriff, and he sent him to the State Department of Correction, to the SLED program. But that, does that automatically put him in solitary?
The restrictions that are placed on pretrial detainees who become safekeepers appear to be consistent with solitary confinement.
Be in solitary, but you could also not be in solitary, right?
That is not what happened here.
But the question is, you know, the sheriff's got to have personal involvement in this thing in order to be. Do you think it's unconstitutional for him to refer this fellow to the SLED program?
I think that if he is intending to impose greater restrictions on Mr. Williamson to punish him for alleged misconduct, then yes, I think would be unconstitutional.
The question in this case is whether putting him in solitary is what is the violation of his rights, correct?
Yes, the violation of his rights is that he was imposed.
Where's the evidence that the sheriff? You're more familiar with the record than I am. Where's the evidence that the sheriff knew the guy was in solitary?
I would have to look specifically for evidence of what Carroll knew.
What about the jail administrator, Charlton? Is she a party on this appeal?
She is a party on this appeal.
So what she signed the disciplinary forms in the local jail and determined the punishment there. She didn't have anything to do with what happened at the State Department of Corrections, did she?
As far as the record shows, she doesn't have any involvement once he leaves the local county detention center.
And then the same thing is true of the two local prosecutors. One of them went and got some sort of an order sending this fellow there. Aren't the correct defendants in this case Sterling and Rogers, the DOC director and the manager of the Lee Correctional Facility?
Your Honor, we would submit that the correct defendants are everyone who was involved in seeking and maintaining the safekeeper order, and that requires involvement.
You think everybody got a say in all the defendants you had a case against?
I think, to be clear, Director Sterling, who's in charge of the State Corrections Department.
He's the umbrella man. He's the state director.
Yes, but he's also the one who's charged under Executive Order 2011 with making the safekeeping application.
For the governor.
He works for the governor.
And the governor issued the order.
That's correct,
and
Your Honor.
Didn't sue the governor.
He did not sue the governor, Your Honor.
He didn't sue the governor.
Director Sterling, however, is charged with making sure that the safekeeping application.
So everybody you've sued is an underling.
Well, doesn't Sterling routinely approve the renewals of inmate solitary confinement?
In this case, he approved and recommended for the initial safekeeping order as well as all subsequent 11 ones, including, you know. Here, especially when we look at the renewals of these safekeeper orders, we know that there's a serious due process issue that perhaps these orders would not have been granted had defendants gone out and done the relevant fact-finding as required by Executive Order 2011. The governor has ordered the director of the state, the Director Sterling, both make sure that the application is consistent and also gather other relevant facts and make a recommendation to her.
Right. I understand your point is to Sterling, but The local people, the sheriff and Ms. Charlton, they were just referring somebody that they thought had a problem. it wasn't really their duty to investigate further, was it? Their job was to hand him off, say, this guy might be a safekeeper. You need to look at it. But then it seems to me they were out of the picture. How are they proper parties in this case?
Well, Sheriff Carroll, he's a proper party because he has to. The safekeeper order is expired.
You say the sheriff's proper party?
Yes, the sheriff is a proper party because he has to seek the initial one as well as maintain, as well as seek the additional renewals.
Okay, and so you're saying he rubber stamped the renewals?
Yes, that he rotely sought the renewals of the safekeeper order.
Yeah, but he didn't ask for solitary confinement, did he?
It appears from the record that. That the actual placement of defendant is required by South Carolina Department of Regulations to be in an administrative segregation in a solitary environment.
You saying everybody in this SLED program gets put in solitary?
In the safekeeper program, it appears so. It appears that they're confined to their cells for 23 hours.
If you're
a
in
day.
The safekeeper program, you're in solitary confinement. Is that what you're telling us?
Where That's does what, the yes. record show that?
The record shows that at
or you can do it when you come back.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
But that's pretty significant here. What about this fellow Rogers? How you got him in this case?
He was added in the second amended complaint.
He was added in the Second Amendment complaints, which after the summary judgment order.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And then it was dismissed without prejudice. And how do you have jurisdiction here? If the case in the district court's still viable as to Rogers, how is there jurisdiction in this case? The case is not over.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because of Rogers.
Yes.
Well, then how we got anything to do here?
No.
You have to have a final decision under Section 1291 to take an appeal.
I apologize, Your Honor. I misunderstood your question.
Well, I'm asking a pretty significant question, I think, because it looks to me like Rogers is not a proper party here.
My
looks to me like the case is still viable as to him in the district court.
My understanding, Your Honor, is that this court has jurisdiction because the Second Amendment complaint was dismissed under the initial review provisions under the PLRA.
It was dismissed without prejudice, reportedly.
Yes.
After the final order, after the so-called summary judgment order.
Yes, Your Honor.
So. Has Rogers amended his complaint?
No.
What about the Domino Sugar case?
The Domino Sugar case? For this court to have jurisdiction, it has to have a final order, and we're appealing from the final order that was issued.
How do you have a final order if a case is not over?
Well, it was dismissed with prejudice, Your Honor.
It wasn't dismissed with prejudice. It was dismissed without prejudice. If I said with prejudice, I was wrong. It was dismissed without prejudice.
One moment, Your Honor.
It was purportedly amended after the summary judgment order, and then it was dismissed without prejudice. And then it was dropped as to the other fella, but Rogers is still in it, purportedly. You still got him. Somebody's representing him.
No, Your Honor,
he filed a brief up here, supposedly.
No, Your Honor, my understanding
is the case still pending against him in the district court.
My understanding is the district court amended its judgment on July 20th, 2017, which made it a final order dismissing both defendant Roger.
But it was dismissed without prejudice.
No, I believe it's.
I think it was someone on the 25th of the July, too. You're looking at the docket sheet?
I'm not looking at the docket sheet.
Yeah, I looked at that myself.
Okay.
After July 20th, there's more stuff.
Right. Because we had to amend the notice of appeal after the district court ordered its final, after the district court's judgment became final in this court, or became final in the court below. So my understanding is that we do have jurisdiction because they were dismissed with prejudice when the district court.
If there's still if his case is still viable, is there any jurisdiction here?
No, this court would have to order a remand.
We can't order a remand if there's no jurisdiction. We can't do anything.
Then the court, then the case should be active in the district court of South Carolina below.
I mean, there's nobody sought a 54B, Rule 54B appeal.
Correct. We haven't sought for interlocutory review in this case. I apologize, Your Honor.
I'm sorry.
We did not seek for interlocutory review at this time. So because our belief is that the judgment is final as to all defendants, including the two later added
including Mr. Rogers.
Including Mr. Rogers, and I believe Ms. Eastridge, who were added in the second amended complaint. My understanding is that the court dismissed them originally without prejudice. He did not amend his complaint, and that order became final, and we amended the notice of appeal to include those. So this court does have jurisdiction. Turning to the errors of the district court's opinions here below, the district court made two legal errors that each warrant a remand. First, the court misapplied precedent when holding that pretrial detainees are not entitled to any due process when it's for administrative reasons. Second, the court failed to consider whether the solitary confinement was excessive or arbitrary, and defense abuse of the safekeeper process is circumstantial evidence of the intent to punish Mr. Williamson for his alleged misconduct. The court should vacate and remand to the district court order with instructions, first to consider whether Mr. Williamson presented any evidence that his solitary confinement was excessive and therefore intended to punish. And if the answer to that question is yes, the district court must consider whether Mr. Williamson received process under Wolfe McDonnell. If the answer to the question is no, that the solitary confinement was for administrative reasons, the district court must consider whether Mr. Williamson received process required by Hewitt v. Helms. In short, Mr. Williamson received no process at all in connection with more than 3 years of solitary confinement. His due process rights were violated, and either error is sufficient to order a remand. turning to the error where the court found that pretrial detainees do not have the same rights as convicted inmates for administrative segregation purposes, the district court relied on the Seventh Circuit case in Higgs v. Carver to find that there was a disagreement between the Seventh Circuit, the Second Circuit, and the Third Circuit about whether pretrial detainees are entitled to process for administrative segregation. To be clear, the courts of appeals are unanimous in holding that for administrative segregation, there is some process required for pretrial detainees prior to being put in administrative segregation. Subsequent to Higgs, the second.
How many due process claims you got? One or two?
If we look at the, if we count the orders all together.
No, I'm talking about substantive due process or procedural due process.
We have both. We have two claims.
You have two. You have a substantive claim and a procedural claim.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
The substantive.
Now they say in their briefs that you never raise a substantive claim. You only have a procedural claim.
That's correct. They are wrong, Your Honor. The initial brief makes clear that the substantive due process claim is that he was punished without receiving any process,
right.
And that's the substantive. And I know it's a little tricky because we're all talking.
And
about,
he was raising these things himself pro se.
That's correct. And his second amended complaint.
So is your argument that we need to interpret it in favor of him liberally?
Well,
give you two claims in that regard.
He specifically alleges it in his amended complaint. If you look at paragraphs 10 and paragraphs 11 of the amended complaint, Mr. Williamson says that he was sent to the safekeeping program with the intent to punish him for this alleged misconduct without any process, and that makes that a substantive due process claim.
And the substantive due process claim is that there's no reasonable relationship between the government conduct and a legitimate non-punitive objective, and therefore we can infer that there's punitive intent. Is that fair to say?
Yes, Your Honor. I would make one slight addendum for it is that he believes that there's evidence that the reason that defendants gave for putting him in the safekeeping program is not for administrative reasons, but it's for to punish him for this alleged misconduct.
Well, but there's either way, it doesn't relate to any legitimate objective after a certain amount of time. Isn't that right?
Yes, Your Honor. And here also, we have evidence that not only did the solitary confinement become less, the reason for holding him there was not as salient in the beginning as it was later. We also have evidence that the solitary confinement, in fact, I see that my time's up.
You go ahead and answer questions as long as you get them.
there's also evidence here that the solitary confinement actually harmed Mr. Williamson because he became mentally ill while under their care.
Do you want to use a minute of your rebuttal to talk about the issue of sovereign immunity?
Sovereign immunity as even prosecutorial immunity as to Solicitor Miller?
No, I'm talking about sovereign immunity, the court's ruling on that.
The court below ruling on sovereign immunity?
I'm asking you whether, well, never mind. If you're not concerned, then I'm not.
All right. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Lindemann?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Andrew Lindemann. I represent the appellees Brian Sterling as well as Clarence Rogers. Part of the problem in looking at this appeal is something that Judge King just touched on a few moments ago, and that is whether or not you have a procedural due process claim and a substantive due process claim, or a procedural due process claim alone.
Well, what procedure did this fella have to get himself out of there?
Well, first of all, our contention is that what has been brought here and what has been appealed is a procedural due process claim, and they're conflating the two. Now, touching on your question, Judge Gibney, the safekeeper process allows for a pretrial detainee who has certain issues in a local detention center. In this case, they were substantial, in fact, written as well as oral threats to kill law enforcement officers.
So what process was he entitled to?
He was, because it was an administrative process, he was not being punished. He was essentially being moved from one facility
to another. Well, maybe it's not your idea of punishment, but it's pretty much everybody else's, I think, to be sitting there for 3 years in solitary.
Well, certainly at the point in time when he was moved, I mean, he was a detainee. There was no anticipation as to how long.
At some point in time, he was tried and acquitted.
He was tried and acquitted on one charge and then pled guilty to another charge and was received time served.
Does everybody in this safekeeper program that he's in get put in solitary?
Well, you call it solitary. What it is they have they.
Does everybody get put in administrative segregation?
They all get put in,
to use the nicer term.
Yes, they all are put in administrative.
So they're all by themselves
because they have to be kept separate.
So the sheriff would know that this guy was in solitary. Then
I can't speak to what the sheriff would know or not know.
Is that in this record? What safekeeping is defined as?
Yeah, the safekeeper policy as well as the executive order are in the record. Now,
and they lay it out
for the most part. Now, practically,
for the most part,
right? I mean, it talks about that typically a safekeeper is placed at Lee Correctional Institution, and it is in a restrictive housing unit.
And is in solitary confinement or not?
Well, I mean, what they're calling solitary confinement, I mean, they are housed in a cell by themselves. They are restricted from having
23 hours a day.
They're restricted from having access to other inmates.
So then every safekeeper
is inmates are convicts.
So then every safekeeper is in solitary confinement.
Is housed in a cell. Yeah, I mean, to what is being described as solitary confinement, yes. And it's no different than
23 hours a day, 7 days a week.
It's no different. It's totally analogous, in fact, to protective custody, for instance, for convicts. What you're doing is you're keeping
except
them
you're not
separate.
Getting protected from anybody except your own.
Well, they're
contact with your family.
They're being they have visitation rights. They're not
contact with your fellow
right,
human.
But this is a pretrial detainee. I mean, doesn't that make all the difference in the case that this man was being held pretrial? in solitary confinement for three years.
I recognize that. Now, the safekeeper system, and it's not unusual. I mean, South Carolina is alone. Safekeepers are is a system that's used in correctional systems across the country.
Is it just as to pretrial detainees?
Yes. Safekeepers are pretrial detainees. Detainees, that's correct.
And Judge Gibney had a question. I interrupted.
I don't think that's correct.
My understanding is a lot of jurisdictions.
I used to represent every sheriff in the state of Virginia, and I can tell you that that's not what happens here.
Okay, I can't speak to Virginia, but I believe safekeeper statutes are relatively common. But I stand to be corrected.
Didn't anybody in South Carolina scratch their head at some point and say, this guy's been in here 3 years, maybe we ought to do something about this?
Well, part of the issue with that is, of course, he was subject to stand in trial, and there were numerous issues that were created primarily by himself and his counsel.
Well, the only issue on the record is
going to get a trial.
Is he made this threat early? Did he make additional threats down the road?
No, he made that threat in writing and then verbally.
That's what occasioned the original safekeeper determination. Is there anything in the record that shows that at all these 90-day renewals, there was any independent determination made whether there was other evidence to warrant keeping him, or that the original evidence constituted sufficient evidence to consider the continuation of detention?
Well, the initial threat never went away. I mean, it didn't vanish.
How did that initial threat remain alive? Hey, the guy's in solitary.
Well, he had made those threats. I mean, it was in writing, number one. And number two, he voiced the exact same threat verbally to a SLED agent who was interviewing him.
Did he do it again and again and again?
No, there's no record of him.
He just did it at the beginning.
Later, that's correct.
And they kept him for 3 years in solitary on the basis of these original threats. And at one point, there was a bond hearing, right? In 2015?
I don't recall that in the record.
I thought there was something about reference to a bond hearing.
It's very possible. I don't recall that.
You don't know whether he was taken to court?
That in the record.
Okay.
Well, now, on this issue of qualified immunity, and I may owe Mr. Johnson an apology, I may have been saying sovereign immunity and not qualified immunity.
Yes.
How does the district court get to the point of saying that there's entitlement to qualified immunity in this case when it's clearly established law that convicted inmates have a right to process before this kind of action is taken against us, and it's also against them, and it's also clearly established law that pretrial detainees have at least the rights of convicted inmates? How did the district court legally reach the determination that these officials were entitled to qualified immunity when the law is really pretty clear on that?
Well, I would disagree with that, Judge Keenan. And what the analysis that the district court did was looking specifically at a safekeeper situation. And again, that is a situation where a person, because of their conduct, in this case, very egregious conduct and threats, were placed in the South Carolina Department of Corrections as a safekeeper. Now, there's no fair notice. There's no statutory. I mean, there's no case law that provides any guidance how that's to be handled. Now, at that particular time in 2013, that was even before this court issued its Dilworth opinion. And in Dilworth, of course, this court for the first time joined its sister circuits, as it put, and found that when a pretrial detainee is put into disciplinary detention, they are entitled to due process. Well, of course, this is not being placed into disciplinary detention.
If they did this with intent to punish, then you lose this case on substantive due process grounds, right?
If they did this with intent to punish, it would be an issue of
procedural due process.
Right?
No, it would be substantive due process.
There's absolutely no evidence intent to punish.
It would be substantive due process if they did it with intent to punish.
No, then you would require a hearing. See, that's the problem with this case. The two claims are being conflated.
Listen to Judge Gibney's question.
You know, the analysis for a substantive due process claim is deliberate indifference.
No. Analysis is intent to punish, isn't it?
No.
If they did it with intent to punish, then he's
then he's being punished, and then it's not allowed to happen, right?
If the issue is the placement in
administrative segregation, you can't be punishing him before he's convicted.
It becomes a conditions
You can hold him case. Pending trial.
That's correct.
Okay, so is it your contention then that a safekeeper is entitled to less process than a convicted inmate?
No, but they're very, very different situations. A convicted inmate.
Okay, so are you saying then that a safekeeper is entitled to the same level of process as a convicted inmate?
No, in this particular instance, as a safekeeper, it's specifically administrative segregation. You're being moved from one facility to another. To the extent that there's a challenge to conditions, I beg to differ. I think that is a substantive due process claim, and a conditions case under this court's numerous cases apply a deliberate indifference standard, and that has not been pursued in this particular case.
All right. Tell me on the 900th day this guy is in solitary what the reasonable relationship is between that and a legitimate non-punitive government objective.
Well, the legitimate—
The 900th day.
900th day.
Not the first.
It didn't change from the first. He had made those threats to kill law enforcement officers, as well as a circuit court judge and his family, and that threat hadn't changed.
But we're not talking about releasing him to the community. We're talking about releasing him to the prison population, and there are all sorts of murderers who are in the prison population who aren't in safekeeper. So how can you use that as the rationale for continuing to keep him as a safekeeper as opposed to it being in the general prison population?
Well, with all due respect, Judge Keene, that's the problem with your analysis is you can't release a safekeeper into the general
prison
population.
Okay, well, then what can you do?
Because you can't intermingle them with convicts.
Okay, so then what do you do? And I appreciate your helping me here because I don't know what happens, behind the wall. What happens then if somebody no longer qualifies for safekeeping but has not been tried?
They're returned to a local detention center.
Okay. Well, then why wasn't that option considered on a 90-day basis? There's nothing in the record that shows that he was interviewed during this three-year period, that anybody evaluated him for purposes of whether he would be returned to the local local jail. There's just nothing that supports the continued detention, it seems.
The request was made on a renewal basis by the local sheriff asking for the safekeeper status to be renewed, and that decision was made by the governor, who incidentally, as Judge King pointed out, has not been sued in this case. The governor is the decision maker in this safekeeping process.
She was the decision maker in every instance?
She issued each renewal order as well. That was required by statute as well as by the executive order.
And it was requested by the sheriff?
The sheriff would make a request for the renewal and 90-day interview.
Is the record complete on all that? All those renewals?
The renewals, I believe, are all in the record.
But are they all complete? Is the record complete as to what everything was done
That's correct.
On those occasions?
That's
every
correct.
90 days?
Right. And the role of my client, Brian Sterling, is important to recognize.
Well, you've got a client named Rogers, too. And I asked a question earlier about the situation with him. Do you take a position that we got jurisdiction in this appeal?
I don't. I think the Domino Sugar case does apply. You're exactly correct. He's never been served with process.
Maybe that undermines what I was saying then, if he was served. But you say you represent him. You say he's on appeal, but if we can only hear appeals from final orders, and that means a district court case is over with.
I'm only a final judgment. I've only made an appearance for him, Judge King, because they have identified him as an appellee in the case.
Okay.
And quite frankly—
Is it a special appearance or any kind?
Well, I don't know that I would call it that. I don't believe we have those anymore. I might be mistaken.
Okay.
But the bottom line is with Mr.
Rogers— you're here for him for whatever purpose he's here, if he's here at all.
Mr. Rogers, and
But y'all haven't raised any—nobody's raised any question of jurisdiction. I mean, I just—
stumbled on that. But I mean, I looked at that, and I
think you're right about the Domino Sugar case.
They say it's dismissed without prejudice. The order says it's dismissed without prejudice.
That's right, and without issuance of process.
And is there something still pending in the district court,
or
is it over with?
It's not pending in the district court, but it's without prejudice. So in theory, he could refile it. Of course, Mr. Rogers has absolutely nothing to do with the safekeeper process. He was a correctional officer at Lee Correctional Institution, and he was being sued on some of the conditions.
Before we can consider any of that stuff, we have to have jurisdiction.
I agree. Now, as far as Mr. Sterling goes, who's my other client, Mr. Sterling, as I indicated, does not make any decisions about.
But he's the boss man.
Safekeeper. He's, excuse me?
He's the boss, isn't he?
He's the director of the Department of Corrections.
Does he work directly to the governor, to the governor?
He does report directly to the governor.
He doesn't order the sheriff to do anything.
He does not. Go ahead.
What have these lawyers got to do with it? The prosecutor, the solicitor, and the deputy solicitor?
Well, their counsel has a few minutes. I'll probably defer to him to speak to his role, if that's okay with your honor. As far as Mr. Sterling goes, as I was indicating, he doesn't make the decision. What he essentially does is receive the application, make certain it's in order, and makes a recommendation to the governor.
Well, he moved him around different places, and he's the one that kept him in there 23 hours a day.
The system places them in administrative segregation. There is no other place to put them. They have to be kept separate from convicts.
You're saying that a pretrial detainee is either in the local detention facility or in Safekeeper. There's no other alternative.
That's correct. And we have no other facility to be able to provide them, put them in. It's no different than a protective custody situation where you're put in administrative segregation.
Don't interrupt Judge Keenan.
I'm sorry. And I didn't mean to talk over you either. I thought you were
You were
pausing there. On these 90-day renewals, is there any evidence that Williamson was notified, that his attorney received notice?
I don't believe there's any
that anybody
any
received
notice in the
it
record.
Either. Okay. So under South Carolina process, you're saying nobody has to receive any notice, that this just gets stamped again and again and again and again, and it's okay?
Well, again, it's an order issued by the governor under the executive order. The executive order does not require any type of notice at that particular
No type point. Of notice to the pretrial detainee.
That is correct. And so what my client was following was state law. It was following the executive order. That's one of the reasons
does executive
why
order have
the, entitled to qualified immunity.
Does the executive order have the force and effect of law in South Carolina?
It does, yeah.
Well, the question of qualified immunity isn't whether it follows state law. It's whether it's whether it's arguably compliant with federal law.
Well, obviously, there's some case law from this court, including the Springman case, that says one of the things the court looks at when you're dealing with unique issues of law is whether or not the state law that is at play has been interpreted. Of course, the United States Supreme Court has said that as well in the North Carolina, I think, versus LaRue, if I remember correctly, case, talking about mistakes of law will give rise to qualified immunity. So
well,
if there's a mistake of law,
the court says you don't get qualified immunity when it's so bad that anybody could see it's unconstitutional.
Well,
isn't that right? Isn't that what Hope v. Pelzer pretty much says?
Well, Hope v. Pelzer talks about that. I don't believe this case falls within the scope of that. I certainly would disagree.
Well, he didn't get
any
notice on any of these renewals. What there must have been a dozen of them. That sure smells of failure of due process of some kind.
But he wasn't entitled to.
You said he didn't get any notice.
It's our position.
No notice under the executive order, but the Constitution requires some notice.
It doesn't in this instance because he wasn't placed in there with any expressed intent to punish. There was a legitimate non-governmental, non-punitive reasons for him being placed in safekeeper status. It was an administrative decision. We relied, as did the lower court, on the Seventh Circuit case law. There was no case law in the Fourth Circuit that indicated otherwise. The Dilworth case came out in 2016, but it wasn't exactly on all fours with this, did not specifically answer that question. In fact, the district court said there is no guidance from the Fourth Circuit on this particular issue for her to make a decision. That was part of her reasoning in granting qualified immunity for the money damages claims. I see my time is up. I know there's a little bit of time is reserved for Mr. Plyler.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Plyler?
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, who are you representing?
Originally, I represented appellees Hammack and Miller, but appellee Hammack has been dismissed already.
Well, you don't represent appellee Hammack then, because there are no such person. Who do you represent? Miller?
Just David Miller. Appellee
the prize Charles.
I thought he's the
solicitor.
Deputy solicitor?
Yes, Your Honor.
Who represents the sheriff?
Dave DeMasters at co-counsel's table. And I'm going to address, I think, two issues.
But he's not on here to argue. So you arguing for the sheriff, too?
I'm going to address the issue of personal involvement, which I think applies to the sheriff and appellee Charlton as well.
Okay.
But I think it's crystal clear with the solicitor, and I think that it's been somewhat touched on.
But the solicitor, he's claiming absolute immunity.
Well, we're claiming two things, Your Honor. The first argument we made was lack of personal involvement, that there's no evidence in this record that – and I think this is important for us to not lose sight of. There are two layers of decision that are being made here. The first one is what people have been conflating with the second one, and that shouldn't happen. The first is, can he legally be moved to the South Carolina Department of Corrections? And that's a safekeeper decision set up by statute and involves the governor's office issuing an executive order. That is no different than essentially a bond hearing or a bond order, which just allows this person to be detained. The second layer of decisions that's being made here is, what conditions is this person being housed on under at the Department of Corrections? What I'm hearing on the appeal and from the panel is a focus on the conditions seem to have triggered some right to due process. And without conceding that, because I don't think that's important to my clients, the evidence in the record shows that my client, David Miller, had no part whatsoever in deciding what conditions this person was going to be housed under at the Department of Corrections.
Well, Miller's sole job was done after the initial referral to the SLED program.
Well, and it's I know you said a SLED program, Your Honor. It's actually issued. It's administered through the governor's office.
What's
and it's just
difference?
An order. Well, the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, SLED, is a separate.
It's called the Safekeeper Program.
Well, it's a designation of safekeeper. That just under South Carolina law, you can't go to the Department of Corrections without a conviction of more than 90 days or a safekeeper order from the governor's office. That's essentially the pass that gets you through the door.
But safekeeper is a pretrial detainee in every instance?
Not every instance.
Not every
technically,
instance.
Technically, if we get real technical, and I hate to bring this up, but the death row program would also technically.
And the safekeeper is kept in solitary confinement?
By decisions made through policy at the Department of Corrections. And the focus I'd like to, for this small portion of the argument, Your Honors, is to focus on the fact that defendants appellees Charlton, Carroll, and Miller had no part in the decision of what conditions is Williamson going to be housed under once he gets to the Department of Corrections.
Were they ever involved in this thing after the original designation?
I'm not sure that Charlton was involved ever. Miller's sole involvement would be similar to what we see in the DeBabna case, which is going to bring me to the prosecutorial immunity argument in a minute. But in the DeBabna case, it was simply seeking an order. The prosecutor involved in a case that is pending on his desk, criminal charges that he's responsible for pursuing, is seeking an order. And that's what happened here with Miller. Essentially, the sheriff would take on the role, if we want to analogize it, to a victim who is asking that someone seek this order. Then a decision is being made by the governor's office of whether the order should be issued, which results in him walking through the doors at Department of Corrections or staying there. A separate layer of decision is then occurring. That separate layer of decision is, what conditions are we going to house him under when he gets there? And Mr. Lindemann's already addressed, and I think adequately, the fact that there is a non-punitive, legitimate peniological interest in keeping separate non-convicted inmates from convicted inmates. Now, the department has chosen to do that through administrative segregation. And I think he's already addressed that point. But I know I'm getting short on time here. What I want to make sure that the panel is aware of is, if the panel is going to decide that the conditions triggered a due process right and that Mr. Williamson did not get due process, we still have to look at the personal involvement issue here. Was there personal involvement of each appellee in the actual constitutional violation.
Did the district court rule on personal involvement?
Your Honor, I think they kind of skimmed over it.
Didn't the district court expressly say that she wasn't going to address that?
Right. I believe that is what the report and recommendation
said. As to Miller, the district court gave him absolute immunity.
Yes, and finding that there was no constitutional violation for it, they hadn't established constitutional violation at all.
Okay,
didn't reach the next level.
Didn't reach the all right. And what? And as to the other,
The way I read her the report and recommendation is that's kind of what she found on all of.
She just ratified the magistrate judge.
The district court judge, yes,
ratified the magistrate judge's report.
Right. Well, when Your Honor, the first order, there was actually not objections. The objections came were slightly untimely, but I don't think that's a matter on the appeal. But I just want to make sure that it's clear that we.
Well, that's what we're trying to get.
This is helpful. Go ahead there. Stop asking questions? Go ahead.
Yeah. I just wanted to make sure it was clear that there's a separate layer here. Even if it was decided that due process was required and due process was not provided, it has to be on the issue of what was the constitutional violation. The constitutional violation that triggers due process, according to the appellant's argument, is the conditions of confinement, not the decision of whether he qualifies for safekeeper or not, because that's just a question of whether he can legally be detained at the Department of Corrections instead of a local detention center.
Well, but Mr. Lindemann says that safekeeper and solitary go hand in glove.
And if that is true, Your Honor, that my point on the part of these appellees is that's a decision that we were not involved in,
right. Don't
get involved in, and did not make.
And you got any position on whether there's any jurisdiction here for this appeal?
Well, since, Your Honor, I don't represent Mr. Rogers, I hadn't looked into it.
Well, it would affect your appeal, too, because we only hear appeals from final decisions.
Yes, Your Honor. The order, as I read it, was decided in the PLRA's initial review process, and it was dismissal without prejudice without issuance of service of process. So I don't know that he was ever even the district court ever had jurisdiction.
What's that mean in the context of whether your client is a proper appellee? Do you know?
No, Your Honor, I don't. And I would defer. I know Mr. Lindemann.
We're a court of limited jurisdiction, and we hear appeals when the case below is over.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's got to be over.
And the case against my client was over, and I think has already been.
I know it was, but that doesn't get the case over.
Yes, Your Honor.
You can have part of it over and not some of it not over.
Thank you again for your time. If there's no further questions.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Mr. Johnson?
Okay, Mr. Johnson, now that I've got my immunity straight.
Thank you.
Tell me whether we need to, if we agree with your position regarding the issue of punishment, that is an issue that should not have been resolved on summary judgment. Do we address the qualified immunity issue?
Your Honor, I think that it's not. We can win on the remand with
right,
just
but I'm,
with just
I'm
the
just
first
one. Asking you, what is your position on whether this court needs to reach it, should reach it? Please enlighten us.
I think the court should reach it in this case, especially given the positions taken by defendants in their briefs in the court below and in here. What we have here is defendants saying that they needed a specific Fourth Circuit precedent saying that South Carolina safekeepers must receive due process before being put into solitary confinement. And that's a level of specificity and particularity that's unnecessary under the Fourth Circuit law and also under Supreme Court law. So I think it would be helpful for this court to reiterate its holdings that when defendants engage in conduct that breaks bright-line rules, such as here, where we know that pretrial detainees have the same or greater rights as convicted criminals, and convicted criminals receive due process for administrative segregation. So I think it would be helpful for this court to reach the second issue on qualified immunity.
Well, let's assume for just a second that there was a legitimate reason to put him in the safekeeper program.
I think an interesting qualified immunity question is, when does it become too much? When do they conclude that his substantive due process rights have been violated by continuing him in that program? Is it after 100 days or 5 days or 300 days or what?
Judge Gibney, you get a good point where the district court below, the magistrate judge did not actually address that second portion of the Bell test here. The magistrate judge just said, you know, there's a threatening letter. There's a legitimate reason to put him in solitary confinement, and that's all that's required. Versus the district court should engage in this fact-finding mission on remand so the record can be more fully developed in this case. Very quickly, I want to address Judge King's
concerns. You all weren't involved in it. You're a law firm.
That's correct, Your Honor.
We're not involved in it in the district court at all.
That's correct, Your Honor.
He was pro se during the entirety of those proceedings?
Yes, Your Honor. And for most of it, he was also in prison at the time.
Okay, go ahead.
Sorry, just to address your issue for the jurisdictional, whether this court has jurisdiction, when the complaint was not amended, then that order would have become, from the district court, would have become a final appealable order. We'd be happy to submit very short letter briefs addressing this issue to help assuage the court's concerns as to jurisdiction. Judge King, you also asked about a bond hearing where that was on the record. You can find there's at least an excerpt from it at JA 530 through 531 where there's a bond hearing where my client's defense attorney was talking about how the restrictions at Kirkland were so bad that it was difficult for her to even meet with him. And then one other issue for personal involvement.
So there was a bond hearing. I think it was November 2015.
There was at least one bond hearing there.
And bond was denied, I guess.
Yes, bond was denied.
And what happened? Was that before the judge that he supposedly threatened? or do you know?
I don't know. I know that the judge that was allegedly threatened held on to procedural issues for this case. For the criminal case until they could find a judge to take care of the criminal portion. Sorry.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off there.
I was finished, Your Honor.
Mr. Johnson, what about the fact that this was apparently a binary decision that had to be made? There weren't a lot of choices. In other words, according to your opposing counsel, there were only two things that could have been done, safekeeper or local jail. Does that change the analysis at all? You know, when I came into this, I thought there might have been other, most penal systems have other options available. But what if the only option, and I'm assuming that counsel's correct because, you know, this is their wheelhouse, that the only options available were safekeeper or local jail? Does that make your case... does that weaken your case at all?
Your Honor, I don't think it necessarily weakens our case, assuming that that's true. The decision to escalate him, especially if we transition to the renewals of that order, where there is a binary choice that's being made between where should Mr. Williamson be kept, because certainly any justification for the initial upgrade to the solitary confinement certainly has diminished as time went on. And, you know, also for them to renew these safekeeper orders, there's a different standard. They're supposed to show that there were changed conditions that there was no change in conditions, or they're supposed to show good cause to keep him there. And there's no evidence in the record that occurred. And as a safekeeper, he had no disciplinary infractions for the 3 years.
You're saying that every 90 days there had to be a new finding of good cause?
Yes, Your Honor. Good cause or no change in condition.
And does the record reveal that there was a new finding every 90 days of good cause?
No, Your Honor. The record shows that they were renewed each time, but it doesn't show the reason for why they were renewed. It shows that, you know, while he was a pretrial detainee at the local jail, he received 3 disciplinary infractions and served 4 days in lockup as a result of that. And then after, when he was a safekeeper, his behavior improved significantly, where for the second 120 days, he had no disciplinary infractions. And every 90 days thereafter, he still received no disciplinary infractions here. For very quick, I know we're way over.
Just keep wait and finish. I've got another question for you.
Oh, well, for personal involvement issues, we would say that the court assumed below, that assumed without deciding whether or not each defendant was personally involved. As we found out, this is a very fact-intensive inquiry that should be delegated down to the district court on first review. It's important here to note that without defendants Carroll, Miller, Sterling, there would be no safekeeper orders coming out of here because they had to both seek them. Solicitor Miller had to concur with them, and then Director Sterling.
And that's enough involvement. That they're just like cogs in the wheel or something?
They're not cogs in the wheels. One initiates, one concurs, and the other one makes a recommendation.
The person
based
who made
the
decision
evidence.
Is the governor, who's not even here.
But the governor would not be able to make that decision.
You're liable for signing one paper, and you don't even sue the governor.
Your Honor, the governor would not be able to make that decision without these three individuals concurring.
I got all these law clerks running around here trying to help me make decisions, too. And nobody thinks they make any. I'd make them.
Your Honor, in regards to this, even the governor's executive order delegates responsibility down to Director Sterling to both compile the record and find relevant facts and then make a recommendation to her. And in doing so, the governor is shifting where should there be a hearing, similar to like for magistrate judges make reports and recommendations to district courts that have to be adopted by district courts, and they still allow for process at that point, and that's what we're saying here.
If we send this thing back, if we were to send this thing back hypothetically, would he be pro se again? I mean, he comes up here with one of the great law firms of the world handling this appeal. But then if we were to remand it, he's pro se again. It looks to me like.
Your Honor, I can't say at this point as to whether representation would continue from Winston and Strawn. I know that we're handling this appeal pro bono, and should the court decide that a remand is necessary, the firm will have to make a decision at that time. But we would certainly seek to find, counsel for Mr. Williamson at that time.
We appreciate your efforts here very much, and thank you.
Okay, thank you.
And that goes for everybody on both sides. Let's just say that. Y'all have done a good job. We'll come down and greet counsel, and then we'll take a short break. Is that fair?
Take a brief recess.